From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update podcast from ACC.org. In this view, I want to go over two important pieces of information that were posted on our website this week. The first is a presidential advisory from the American Heart Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists related to cardiovascular disease risk factors among women. And the second, I'm going to review briefly the results of the widely anticipated CABANA trial looking at ablation of atrial fibrillation versus medical treatment. So let's start with the first article. It's entitled Promoting Risk Identification and Reduction of Cardiovascular Disease in Women Through Collaboration with Obstetricians and Gynecologists. This was an important review statement by ACC and ACOG that I think has a lot of merit for us to consider. I think the first thing to say is that the majority of women in childbearing years consider their OBGYN physician to be their primary care doctor. Therefore, that is a very important time for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk factors to be identified and treated, since this is often the only caregiver the individual is seeing. So let's go through some key points from this document that I think are relevant to our learning audience. First, the population-adjusted risk of cardiovascular mortality is actually higher for women, 21%, than it is for men, 15%. Also important, traditional ASCVD risk factors actually may affect women differently than men. For example, women over the age of 65 are more likely to be hypertensive than men, and they're less likely to be adequately treated. Diabetes, obesity, psychosocial factors, and smoking increase the risk of ASCVD in women more than those risk factors increase the risk in men. Also, physical inactivity is the most prevalent risk factor for women. Finally, women are 55% less likely to participate in cardiac rehab after a cardiovascular event than men. Another interesting feature of this review was women may have a predominance of risk factors in the autoimmune space. So they're much more likely to have rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, and scleroderma. And these, of course, increase unique types of cardiovascular risk in women. Also, of course, breast cancer being so common and its treatment, both chemotherapy and radiation have cardiac-specific risks associated with them. Another feature of this review, which I really liked, was the notion of this gestational cardiovascular medicine, and that is sex-specific ASCD risk factors are related to pregnancy and hormonal influences. Remember polycystic ovarian syndrome, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, unsuccessful fertility therapy, menopausal status, and hormone use all have unique features that relate to cardiovascular risk. Pregnancy itself certainly is an important thing for us to think about, and pregnancy complications clearly increase the risk for future risk of ASCVD, preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, gestational hypertension, preterm delivery, low for estimated gestational age birth weight. All of these conditions are important. And even if they resolve after the pregnancy, women who show these tendencies remain at increased risk for ASCVD. For example, preeclampsia and gestational hypertension are associated with a 3- to 6-fold increased risk of later development of hypertension and a 2-fold higher risk for ischemic heart disease and stroke. Another item that I thought was interesting, oral contraceptives do not increase ASCVD risk in women who don't have traditional risk factors. However, if a smoker also takes oral contraceptives, they have a 7-fold increase in CVD risk. Similarly, hypertension associated with patients who are taking oral birth control pills also is a risk factor. Postpartum follow-up visits and well women visits represent a huge opportunity for ASCVD risk assessment and counseling and hopefully risk reduction. Among pregnant women, 30% to 40% have at least one risk factor that can lead to long-term health outcomes, and 20% to 30% already have a predictor for ASCVD risk. Couple thoughts about women with hyperlipidemia. Obviously, the first approach would be dietary, with the DASH diet, Mediterranean or plant-based whole food diet being recommended. In general, the guidelines recommend against statin use during pregnancy. The data for safety are mixed, but at this point, generally not. But pregnant women who have a very high triglyceride, like greater than 1,000 milligrams per deciliter, they may benefit from fibrates, particularly if they have other risk factors such as hypertension or diabetes. Physical activity of moderate intensity is encouraged during pregnancy, and it may reduce the risk of preeclampsia and gestational diabetes. Obviously, traditional risk factors such as metabolic syndrome, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, optimal weight, dietary concerns, physical inactivity, smoking, mental health, and stress, these are all things that should be identified during and after pregnancy. And hopefully this can lead to a strategy where long-term risk assessment and risk reduction is achieved. I thought this was a great review, and this whole notion of gestational cardiovascular medicine, the pregnancy itself being a window into a woman's future cardiovascular risk, is such a powerful notion and one that as a nation we need to embrace in terms of how we provide preventive care. Okay, so let's switch gears and talk about a very recent clinical trial called CABANA. This is catheter ablation versus antiarrhythmic drug therapy and atrial fibrillation. This was presented last week at the HRS meeting. It was a long-awaited trial because the notion of ablation versus drug therapy for atrial fibrillation continues to be debated. So the goal of the trial was to compare the safety and efficacy of catheter ablation compared to drug therapy for the treatment of patients with new onset or untreated atrial fibrillation. The study design, patients were randomized in a one-to-one fashion to either get catheter ablation, about 1,100 patients, or drug therapy, similarly 1,100 patients. The primary ablation was performed with standard techniques with pulmonary vein isolation, wide area circumferential ablation, and then ancillary ablations as needed. The drug therapy arm could be either for rate or rhythm control, and importantly, all patients in both arms received anticoagulants. So the total number enrolled, 2,204. Duration of follow-up was 5 years. Mean age, 67 and a half years. And nearly 40% were women. So the inclusion criteria, paroxysmal, persistent, or long-standing persistent AFib who warranted therapy. The patients either had to be over the age of 65 or, if they were younger than 65, have at least one cerebrovascular accident or a cardiovascular risk factor. Obviously, they had to be eligible for ablation, and at the time of enrollment, they had to be on two or more rhythm or rate control drugs. Other salient features about the patients, 9% had a cardiomyopathy, 15% had chronic heart failure, 10% had had a stroke or a TIA. The AFib was paroxysmal in 43% and persistent in about 50%. 39% of the patients had been hospitalized previously for AFib. And importantly, of the ablation patients, 9.2% crossed over to drug therapy. And in the drug therapy assigned group, 27.5% crossed over to the ablation strategy. The principal findings, primary outcome was death, disabling stroke, serious bleeding, or a cardiac arrest at 5 years, comparing ablation to drug therapy, and the percentage was 8 versus 9.2%, not statistically different. Death, 5.2% for ablation versus 6.1% for drug therapy, again, not statistically meaningful. Serious stroke was present in 0.3%. of ablation, 0.6% of drug therapy, again, not significant. The primary endpoint based on treatment received was a bit of a different story. If the patient got ablation, the primary endpoint was achieved in just 7% versus 10.9% of the medical therapy group, and that was statistically significant, as was mortality, 4.4% versus 7.5%. And death or cardiovascular hospitalization, 41.2 versus 74.9%. So these were not based on the intention to treat categorization, but actually on the treatment received. If we looked at secondary outcomes, death or cardiovascular hospitalization, that did favor ablation, 51.7% versus 58.1%. And time to first AF recurrence, the hazard rate was lower with the ablation hazard ratio was 0.5. A pericardial effusion after ablation was seen in 3%, and ablation-related events, 1.8%. So this is a really interesting trial. I think it illustrates the challenges of doing randomized trials comparing a technical procedure versus medical therapy. If you look at it from the intention to treat, then the studies show that ablation is not superior to drug therapy for cardiovascular outcomes at 5 years among patients with either new onset or previously untreated AFib. There was a significant reduction in death or cardiovascular hospitalization with ablation. And when you look at treatment, ablation demonstrated superior efficacy to drug therapy. So it's an interesting challenge to interpret. A couple of thoughts about this particular trial. The drug therapy arm was very heterogeneous, so it's difficult to figure out whether rhythm control could have been better and rate control could have been better. Also, this is a single-blinded trial, so patients knew whether or not they got an ablation. So there was no sham procedure here. So that, I think, represents also an interesting question based on Simplicity and Orbita and other trials. So large randomized trial, very important trial. Obviously, the patients who ended up getting ablation seemed to do better, but there may have been some selection bias in patients crossing over from the rhythm control group. I have a feeling that this trial is probably not going to have a huge effect on the debate that continues. It certainly suggests that when you're seeing a patient for the first time, if the patient prefers going down the medical therapy arm, this trial would support that. It also certainly supports the notion that if patients don't do well on the medical therapy arm, crossing over to the ablation arm appears to provide excellent outcomes that look every bit as good, if not better, than the group getting medical therapy. So the Cabana trial, I think you may want to look at this online and get a little bit more specifics, but it's an important trial. So I want to thank you for listening to this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I try to pick out a couple of features from the site each week that I think are very relevant to practice. Obviously, all of this information can be found online at the American College of Cardiology's website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much.